This podcast series is brought to you from the University of Winchester. We invite you to listen in as we talk with both academics and practitioners about their approaches to peace building and conflict transformation, discussing some of the most complex and pressing challenges we face in the world today.
So I'm here today with Phil Gittins. He's the Director of Education for World Beyond War, and he's here to share his ideas about youth peace and security. Over to you, Phil.
Thank you so much, and hello to everybody listening here. So thanks so much for the invitation. So I wanted to share a little bit, or I was asked to share a little bit about youth peace and security. And I think in order to do that, we need to start by defining our terms. So one of the terms useful to start off with is youth. So what do we mean by youth? Well, youth means different things to different people in different contexts at different times. The UN thinks of youth as 15 to 24. The African Charter thinks of youth up to 35. And in some contexts, I'm still a youth, up to 40. Having said that, I tend to think of young people, youth, in the brackets of teens up to 29. So there's a little bit about youth. So peace and security. So again, peace means different things to different people. But I think a useful way of thinking about peace is Johann Galton's understanding of negative and positive peace. And then what gets in the way of peace is sometimes issues related to security. So state security, human security, etc., which I can talk a lot about. However, I want to focus on youth, peace and security. So youth, peace and security has always been an area of interest for the peace building field, always. If you look at most spiritual leaders, religious leaders, political leaders, all point to the importance of engaging young people positively in peace and security work. Gandhi, for example, spoke about if we want to achieve real peace in the world, we have to start with children. So it's been about for a long time. It's, however, really accelerated over the last 5 years. The United Nations have recognized that actually following the UN resolution on women, peace and security, 1325, they recognize that we probably need something similar with regards to young people. So 1325, Women, Peace and Security, really set a framework and a foundation for thinking about engaging young people positively in peace and security decision making. So over the last 3 years, there's been three groundbreaking, first of its kind, UN resolutions adopted by the United Nations, which basically say every single member state around the world need to step up their game with regards to including young people more in peace and security decision making and planning and action. So that's great. And of course, as we know, in terms of peace building, the big challenge is how do we move from policy, from paper, to what actually happens on the ground. So there's some great work being done with the United Nations and other organizations, but what we really need to look at, and I wrote about this in various different locations, is how we move from looking at a movement on paper to a people movement. How we go about really partnering young people in these decision-making and action processes. What does that look like on the ground? We don't really know that much. Having said that, there is some great work being done. And at the same time, a groundbreaking research was done, and the lead author was Graham Simpson, called The Missing Piece, if people are interested in checking out, mandated by the United Nations to really look at the role of young people in conflict resolution and peace. And there was many takeaways. One of the ones, the takeaways that stands out, is that Graham and the others that were involved talk about the violence of exclusion. Young people still continue to be excluded from decision-making processes, political, economic, social, etc. So, of course, there's still a lot of work to be done. In order to address those issues, there's a whole set of recommendations that he puts forward. And actually, it's really worth highlighting not just the products of that research. It's really worth highlighting the process of how we go about doing that. Research. As a social scientist, I'm interested in how we go about gathering our data and doing research with communities, not about them, not for them, but with them and engage them in hopefully creating knowledge, you know, would be a great way to go. So the research was done with young people in many different countries, in many different contexts, etc., really listening to their voices. Three of the recommendations that come out, three sets of recommendations, revolve around three different issues. investment. It's clear that we're not investing as much as we should be in terms of engaging young people in peace work. Actually, it's really clear that we're not investing sufficiently in peace work general. When we think about that we invest $2 trillion a year preparing for war or war. Let's put that into perspective. It would cost estimates $30 billion to end global starvation on the planet, and $11 billion estimates it would cost to give everybody on the planet clean access to drinking water. So we're spending so little on preparing for peace. So that was one investment. Let's invest more. Secondly, was inclusion. Let's include young people more in decision-making processes. And there's obviously a continuum from how we include young people, right from, let's say, tokenistic. And there's lots of research and lots of work that does that. Let's bring this young people along because it looks good, etc. You know, right through to co-producing, co-creating, co-designing, co-leading projects with young people. And then the third one is partnership. As we know, in this peace world, we're not going to achieve the results that we want to achieve without engaging young people, but also all generations in building peace. So lots more work needs to be done in terms of partnership.
What are your suggestions as how we better involve young people? I'm especially interested in the research process and how we actually in the planning process of peace building so that they don't just add it on in the end in the implementation phase.
Yeah, well, that's a great question. And that's something that I'm grappling with, interested in, and things like this. So as part of my doctorate work, I was very interested in this as well. My background, although I'm education director, my background comes from kind of a youth work community development background, but also I'm a therapist as well. So I'm also really interested in the process of how you work with people. So I think a really great methodology is participatory action research, which is different to traditional approaches to doing research. If people are interested, I've just wrote an article on this, doing participatory action research as a doctoral student, if people want to check that out. Looks at some of the benefits and challenges of doing research. Participatory action research is different from traditional research in the sense that it does research with the community rather than about them. It's also different in the sense that it's about change. It's not just about understanding the world. It actually believes and builds from this understanding that in order to understand the world, we have to change the world. So within participatory action research projects, it's grounded in rigor. It's very rigorous. It's research driven, and it's about making change and improvement. So as you go through the cycles of processes, planning, acting, evaluating, you're interested in moving and improving your practice on the ground and reflecting on it in such a way that leads to better understandings of your practice, but also improvements in your practice as well. So that would be one way. And I can happily talk about some of the projects that I've done. And right now I'm putting together another project with Cambridge University, which will look at a comparative analysis of three different continents, looking at how we go about engaging young people in peace building processes, but in a different way where it's not just involving them in the planning. It's actually, and it's quite an ambitious project, it's actually going to be involving them in knowledge creation processes as well. So coming up with their own explanations of their own practice, which is what I see from studying this field, quite innovative. So watch this space. I'm in the process of putting the proposal together now.
Okay, thank you. We would love to hear some more about those projects, please.
So each day with my work with World Beyond War, we're very much driven by activism. So World Beyond War, our mandate, very easy task, people, is to end the war system on a global scale. So not just war in Afghanistan, not just war in Iraq, but end the war system. And for some of the reasons that I already said in terms of how much we invest. And I think that in order to, let's think about it. If this podcast or people that are listening are broadly interested in sustainable peace and development, let's say that, right? Or let's work from that assumption. Well, if that is the case, then I would make the case that no viable approach to building and sustaining peace and development in the world does not take into account two things. One, the war system. And that is simply because we're not going to be having a secure where everyone's safe with this war system in place, in the sense that we're always looking around, you know, are this country coming, are this country coming? So we have to look at the war system. Another thing we have to look at is the role of young people. And actually there's more, it's more important now to look at the role of young people. If we look at the latest statistics, 3 billion young people under 30, the statistics that I've seen recently, 1.8 billion between 2010 and 24. That is the largest, fastest growing demographic on the planet. So if we're not involving them in effectively and equipping them to work for peace and security, then we're obviously missing out something. So along those lines, with our World Beyond War work, we do education. We actually have a two-pronged approach to change making. One is education, then we have the educational courses, webinars, and the other one is activism, which we engage young people in taking action in their communities to try and bring about change. I am interested in the research side of things as well. So when I came back to the UK, because I'd lived abroad for many, many years on the ground doing this work, I was asked to go and speak at many different universities, and one of them was Cambridge. And after I did, they said, oh my gosh, that's so cool, the work that you've been doing. Would you be interested in coming here and working with us? And I said, okay, great. And at the same time, I'd love to kind of link it into what we're doing, you know, at World Beyond War. So right now we're putting together a World Beyond War youth network, which will be engaging young people in different parts of the world with this work. The project specifically that we're planning is hopefully a comparative study between two or three different continents, two and three different countries to be determined. One is England, the other one is Colombia, which we already have in place, university support of the dean, support of the faculty, and it will, in its broadest sense, span three or four different parts. The first one is research. Start off with research, finding out from young people themselves what they think the issues are related to peace and development in their context, and then support them to go and do that research in the community. So train them around the principles and ethics of working collaborative to do participatory action research. Then they'll come back and they'll say, right, we want to do our own project. And part of that project might involve them developing capacity around particular issues. So we will then, I will, and who I work with, train them around, let's say, community activism, or train them around peace education or conflict transformation issues to help better prepare them in doing their own projects. So that's the second component, education. Third one, activism. They actually go and do their projects in the community. In order to do the projects in the community, they're supported by adult mentors, which are trained. And again, this is a new project, but it's nothing new. I've done this quite a few times in different places where I've trained university professors, lecturers, youth workers, social workers, etc., to act as mentors for young people when they go and do their projects in the community. Then fourthly, after they've done their projects, there's different ways we think creatively about products. We think creatively about products in the sense that one of the products might be an academic journal. One of the products might not be an academic journal, but it still should be classed as scholarly and legitimate work, okay? Those that are interested in putting together an academic journal will have the opportunity to work with us through support to develop their own explanations of their own learning. And I really like the work of Jack Whitehead, who works in the realm of action research and talks about first person I stories. So when we look at social research, sometimes we're sometimes taught and persuaded, and I was as well when I went through my undergrads and masters and things like this, to kind of take the I out. So don't talk in the first person, you know, always talk in the third person, things like that. And it still goes on today. I think that's just doing it just justice. In fact, I actually think it's not possible. You cannot take yourself out of it. You know, you're embedded in that work. That's particularly the case with action research. So the idea is that young people would provide their own explanations of their own action research projects, with the idea of hopefully creating a theory of their own, what Jack Whitehead would call their own living educational theory. So that is the idea. That's hopefully the process. But of course, we need to get the funding first.
Okay, that sounds really, really interesting. I was wondering, what are your thoughts on inclusion in this as well? Because I think sometimes when we talk about youth or we talk about women, or we sort of assume that there's, you know, a group out there who we can easily walk with, who all have the same, and who can all agree on what peace means, and who will all have similar ideas about what direction they want to go in. You know, and everybody will be included, and, you know, regardless of their gender or religion or ethnicity, or what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, that's a very good question. Yes, you're right. What does inclusion mean? What does participation mean? You know, and there's different, it could be seen on a spectrum. So if you look at specifically related to young people, there's some great work many, many years ago by Hart and Hart, looking at the ladder of participation, right from tokenistic inclusion or participation right through to kind of co-producing all the work. One of the starting points, I think, for a lot of work that we do in the peace field should be the question of what does peace mean to you, right? Because you're right, it means different things to different people. Well, maybe another question, what does inclusion mean? It might not be possible in Syria while the bombs are dropping and things like this to co-produce the projects with them. So it's about making the projects context specific. And that's what my PhD looked at in another book that I should be writing, looking at how we go about contextualizing peace programs to each particular location. And in doing so, that would also look at what should inclusion look like in our context. And the question of inclusion with regards to knowledge creation, I think, is a really interesting one and kind of an undeveloped one, I would say, in the peace building field, specifically as it relates to theory, empirical work, but also practice as well. So we're going into this research not knowing the answers, and that's how really good research should work, right? That we go into it interested in finding out what we're going to find out, even if that does challenge and it, you know, challenge our existing beliefs of what we think inclusion should be, what we think peace should be, etc. Because of course we do have our existing assumptions, and it's important that we recognize that.
So how are you gonna do that on the ground then, when you have a group of young people coming together? Because I still feel that there is still this assumption that there will be some sort of coherent approach to what they want to do, and what if that's not the case?
Yeah, well, that's not the case. I mean, part of the initial assessment is, should we be there in the first place? You know, and if we shouldn't, that's fine. But that let's ask the question. I can tell you now from working on the ground that I've challenged my own assumptions and really learned a lot, and been challenged and grateful that I was challenged to do so by really working with people on the ground. So I'll give you one example. When we come from the perspective of, let's say, a free Aryan approach or a Carl Rogers approach, which is what I'm very much informed by, Carl Rogers or Paulo Freire and their ways of working. Sometimes their ideas around kind of starting with the young people, their ideas of facilitating learning and not teaching, you know, especially Carl Rogers would talk about, you know, we don't talk about teaching, we're talking about facilitating learning. And to some extent, Paulo Freire would also look at that as well. I started from that assumption with most of the work that I do in the past, before really looking at it in depth with the PhD. And I went into research on the ground in Bolivia with that idea that I'm not here to teach people, I'm here to facilitate learning, right? And that's what I was done. And then at times, because we really developed a relationship, and I really want to hit home about these things take time. And I have sometimes a real issue with what the Bolivian people told me, including the directors of the Ministry of Education. They said, we have a problem with traveling scholars. So, okay, what do you mean? And they said, well, coming in here, doing a 2-week research project and then leaving again. So the director at the time of director of gender for the Ministry of Education said, Phil, I'll tell you now, I'm a Marxist and we're not interested in foreigners coming in here and telling us what peace should look like in our context, right? So I love that, you know, I love that, you know, the honesty. And then what I said, and then she followed up the question, I'm just curious, how long have you been here in Bolivia? So then I told her, you know, which was at the time more than 3 years on the ground. And then she said, okay, well, so what have you done? And I said, well, I've helped kind of design different university programs around peace and conflict, and I wrote a book as well with authors in Bolivia called Peace and Conflict in Bolivia. By the way, my wife's Bolivian, and things like this, right? So she was like, my gosh, she said, yeah, that is totally different, you know, that is totally different, because you really can with authority say that you know something about the context Of course, I'm not the expert because the experts are the people that live there, right? So going back to your question, I think it's about being humble and saying that we don't know. I think it's about admitting that we do have our own values. And that's really, really, really important, especially with action research. What are the values that inform our work? And then part of this kind of methodology around this first person stories is to look at yourself sometimes as a walking contradiction. And what they mean by that is that you want to do certain things. For example, I think that the gap between research and action on the ground is not the fault of scholars or academics in the university per se, I don't think. I think it's a way in which this university has been set up, you know, to kind of publish, 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 publish. And I wonder what would have happened with the likes of maybe Marx or something like that, who was put under pressure to produce, you know, his masterpiece within a couple of weeks because he had to gain tenure, you know. So I think it's an issue with the kind of the way in which the system's set up. So I really like this idea of challenging yourself, looking at yourself. And of course, I don't have all the answers. I'm really interested in finding out what's gonna happen when we go on the ground there. You know, with hopefully the idea of being open to being challenged and changing our ways of working, because that's what we're interested in.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think it's also really important that we think about how we make things sustainable when we leave again as well, so that we are actually, I don't know what your thoughts are on that, but.
Yeah, well, that was a really good question. Yeah, thank you. I totally agree. So how do we, I mean, this idea, it's involved quite a lot, the idea of sustainability. And I don't think you could ever really guarantee sustainability. I think you can try and work towards increasing the likelihood of it being sustainable. And one idea would be to try and build capacity or assist in building capacity in that local context so that when you go. Another one would be, of course, to ask the people themselves, you know, what products do you want, or what outcomes, what outputs, what impact do you want from this project? So in this particular case with Bolivia, she was really upfront and said, I'm not interested in reading about your article in a journal that you've written up, you know. And I said, OK, great. What would you like to see? She said, what would be really cool if you put together a training for our team in the Ministry of Education, or a report that we could look at, and, you know, and that would help us inform our work. So she was really interested in hearing, you know, about the research, but she didn't want to be kind of mandated to, it will be a journal article, you know. And so along those lines, what actually happened is that we put together a co-organized conference in the end. It was attended by over 120 people, including Ministry of Education, Save the Children, UN, different universities. We invited the, you know, different people from the Ministry of Education to speak. We provided a platform for the young people to share in their own words their experience of the project and things like this. But this was informed by what they wanted. This was informed by what they said. And then at the same time, while I'm sharing this as well, I want to share that the people on the ground, that in my experience, and it's just my experience, are not against outside ideas per se. They're not against outside international knowledge. You know, they're not. What they're often against is this idea of imposition in terms of outsiders know best. Outsiders can build peace better. You know, that's what they're not. That's what they don't like. So if you go into that relationship with this idea of curiosity, with this idea of wanting to collaborate, not knowing what that collaboration will look like, then generally speaking, I think it will work, because people will see that you're kind of genuinely interested in a collaboration. You're not interested in just kind of purporting your own ideas and telling these communities what peace should look like. And of course, this is not just me. If you look at, a wonderful book I like, Peaceland, she talks a lot about the same thing. And Jean-Paul Lederach have also spoke about the same thing, that international outsiders can make the difference in some cases, not always, in terms of advancing the prospects for peace. So I'm not saying that it should just be 100% local. I'm not saying 100% it should be international, by all means. I'm saying that an interesting collaboration can happen, or what, you know, Oliver Richmond or McGuinty or others would talk about, hybridity. You know, the hybridity, what happens when the international and the local come together. And again, I could talk about how that in itself could be quite controversial as well, and the friction that's involved with that, but that might be for another podcast.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm always quite interested in actually finding that middle ground, because, you know, whenever you arrive anywhere, they also have expectations as to what you can do and what you can provide for them. So negotiating that can sometimes be quite difficult as well.
Yes. Well, can I say something on that, actually? I really can.
Go ahead.
I totally agree with you. It's right. We have our own expectations for human beings, you know, and negotiating that ground, or working through what others would call the friction of working through the international local encounters, is really interesting. So with our hat on at World Beyond War, we work with many different people in different parts of the world. One in particular, I think, is a wonderful, wonderful group in South Sudan, and they're doing so much wonderful work. We are really interested in learning from them. So we're doing right now a 6-week course and online and things like this. And often we're saying, please tell us more about what's going on in your context. Please tell us more about, you know, what share with us as a way of co-learning, as a way of co-sharing what you are doing.
Okay, thank you so much. This has been really, really interesting. Best of luck with your project. I hope we can invite you back in a couple of years' time to hear all the findings and the good work that you have done. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Wonderful. Thank you.